And welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host, our guest author, Father Ben J. Cameron of the Mercy Fathers. His book is Healing the Deepest Wounds, a Pastoral Guide to Abortion, Trauma, and Grief, published by Mater Media and available naturally through the EWTN Religious Catalog, EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. It's great to finally meet you and have you on this program. You were on with Jim and Joy.
Yes.
And you've been on the network on and off over the years, right?
I was on Women of Grace some years ago.
Right, exactly. But of course, the Mercy Fathers are very, very popular here on EWTN, mm-hmm. and they have been for many years. Obviously, Father Wade, as a regular on several series he did for us, and also on his radio show, he does an open line edition as well. So what do you do for the Fathers of Mercy?
I'm a full-time parish missionary retreat master. I was for 4 years pastor of our parish, but mainly preaching parish missions and retreats.
Right. Now, why did you join the Fathers of Mercy? Was it because you felt you had a mission to do missions or what?
I didn't even know what a mission was when I first met the Fathers of Mercy, but the idea of missionary preaching and the concept of a parish mission appealed to me, a retreat for the parish. So I felt the call to priesthood, and then from John Paul II, I felt something he wrote, a call to religious life. And then the Fathers of Mercy, just everything about it just fit for me. And so being missionary, being Marian, being very rural, focused with our parish work. Mm-hmm. It was all kind of a whole bunch of things came together.
What's the goal of a parish mission? We hear about it sometimes in our parishes, they're going to have a mission. What is the goal usually of a parish mission, or particularly the ones that the Mercy Fathers do?
It's a deeper evangelization of a parish, helping people to come to a deeper knowledge and love of Christ, getting people back to the sacraments. So it gives people the opportunity to go to confession to a priest that they don't know and they're not going to see again, at least for a long time. And so that helps a lot of people who've been afraid to go to confession to come. So really, I'd say deeper evangelization of the parish.
Now, the book Healing the Deepest Wounds, A Pastoral Guide to Abortion, Trauma, and Grief. So I'm assuming the deepest wound has to do with dealing with an abortion itself?
Yeah, abortion wounds.
And why did you decide to write a book about this in particular? What was your personal involvement that led you to author this?
So a little over 20 years ago, while I was doing missions and doing a lot of women's retreats, I just saw how many people were struggling with wounds of abortion, deep grief, having trouble forgiving themselves, having trouble believing that God has forgiven them. Mm-hmm. And I looked into finding out more about it, and that led me to Rachel's Vineyard.
Okay.
And so
which you talk a lot about in the book.
Right, I do. Yeah. And I went to a Rachel's Vineyard retreat 20 years ago, actually, in Philadelphia, and it was so profound.
And why did you go?
Because I really wanted to understand better what's going on and how to help people. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, I thought at first, well, I'll just go and observe a retreat. And I said, nobody observes, but you can make a retreat. You can enter into the process. And so I did, and it just was life-changing in many ways. So I came back and asked my superior and our local bishop in Owensboro if I could start it in Western Kentucky. So that's how it got me started. So for the last 20 years, I've been leading Rachel's Vineyard retreats in Western Kentucky and also helping with retreats in Tennessee and Alabama. And just been and very involved in the ministry.
What would you say the greatest thing you learned or walked away from having been on that retreat that you wish, and maybe that's what's why this book is written, you want other ministers, especially in priests and counselors and people who are dealing with people who've had abortions or are in that situation, what did you learn?
Well, I learned from one thing is that it's a very complicated grief. Some people are used to grief like, okay, your spouse died or your parent died. But the abortion grief is a very complicated grief. And there's not a body to bury. Mm-hmm. There's no grave to visit. And the parents have a deep understanding that they were involved in the death of their child. Mm-hmm. Even if the mother was forced or coerced in some way to having an abortion, she still feels like, why didn't I run away? Why didn't I? So it's a grief that is not easy to resolve. And then oftentimes there's a lot of trauma on top of that grief from the procedure, from things that preceded the abortion, and just the very fact of oftentimes being coerced into it. it's a very traumatic event. And right. so it's something that takes a lot of compassion, and that it's not a, well, we're going to sit down, we're going to talk through this.
Right.
That people, I think the best way for people to heal is a very immersive, experiential retreat.
Like
and
a
that's
Rachel's
what
thing,
Rachel's Vineyard
kind
does.
Of a thing. Well, right in the beginning, you kind of have a story that says, you know, a person comes in to see the pastor. Obviously, she's struggling with deep issues here. Does the fact that she can't forget her abortion, does that mean God really hasn't forgiven her? Or does it mean that she doesn't have enough faith? Why can't she forgive herself and move on? Those are the kind of issues people challenge themselves right. with. And he goes, you say, telling a woman or man struggling to accept God's mercy for a past abortion, or another way to say it is get over it and move on, is just not very helpful.
Right.
And that's what yeah. you're really saying.
Yeah, and that's what too often people are told. You know, they're told by family members, by friends, sometimes even by a priest or minister, mm-hmm. well, you've already confessed this. Get over it. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes, well, you made that decision, it was your choice, so you need to just move on. Right. And that doesn't solve the problem.
So when you're dealing with family members like that, is part of that their own guilt and the fact that if you can't move on, then they can't move on in their own way, or what guilt they might feel about association with the event?
Sometimes, mm-hmm. yeah, sometimes, because a lot of time a young woman, she has an abortion not so much because she wants it as because her parents tell her she needs to have an abortion. Or they tell her that, you know, they're not going to support her finishing high school or finishing college, or, you know, this is going to ruin your life. And so they really coerce her. Mm-hmm. And so if she's still wounded by it, they can't just put it out of their mind, mm-hmm. you know. So they actually need to face up a lot of time that they are actually more guilty mm-hmm. than their daughter who had the abortion.
Right. Well, the Holy Father talks about an abortionist being like a hitman. Well, somebody paid for the hit.
Exactly.
You know.
So. And a lot of times it wasn't the mom.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. In chapter one, Grief is Natural, you talk about Adam and Eve. Why'd you start off about Adam and Eve?
Well, because it was with Adam and Eve's fall that death entered the world. One line I use in there is that grief is natural because death is unnatural. We would not have had death except mm-hmm. that Adam and Eve fell. Mm-hmm. So their original sin brought death into the world. And because of that, when we experience death, it's something. We should experience grief with mm-hmm. death, because death is not a natural thing. It should not have happened. It should not okay. be here.
Right. So having grief is natural.
It's natural.
Right.
Because death isn't natural.
Right.
Because we shouldn't have to die.
In chapter two, and you go complicated or traumatic grief, you tell a story about a drunk driver and a situation where a man, I guess his car broke down and he called his sister, and then a drunk driver killed his sister
right.
and his niece or his nephew. And the man blamed himself for the deaths of his sister and his nephew, yet it was actually the fault of the drunk driver. What does that story have to do with somebody suffering under abortion?
It's really setting the stage that oftentimes grief is complicated. It's mm-hmm. not a simple grief. My sister died. He thinks my sister died because I didn't take care of my truck well enough, and because of that my truck broke down. And because of that, my sister came. So somehow I'm at fault mm-hmm. that she's dead. And so that it's not about abortion so much mm-hmm. as the fact that some grief is a complicated grief. There's more to it than, okay, let's just mourn the death of your loved one.
Right.
But a person feels responsibility for
because like
death.
You say, really, the drunk driver killed
exactly.
his sister.
Right.
But through a series of events, he feels guilty of the fact, like you said, if I hadn't done these things, this situation wouldn't
exactly,
occurred.
And that makes it harder to get over.
Right.
You know.
Okay. In chapter three, abortion is often not a free choice. You say we know that abortion is killing of an innocent human child, but we can also feel sympathy for, and we can suffer with someone in this situation. Every abortion has at least three victims. Who are the three victims?
The mother, the father, and the child.
Okay. Well, you say that we all understand it's the killing of innocent, unborn human child. Obviously, during this past election cycle we've been through, there seems to be an entire party, at least, that doesn't
right.
seem to understand that that's, in fact, what it is.
Well, I say we all understand this. it's the audience that's going to read my book. Mm-hmm. You know, so those who have decided that abortion is the sacrament of the secular world
right.
are not going to read my book.
They're, right.
You know, are very unlikely. So, no, they would deny that.
Right. Do you find it kind of odd and ironic that now they're finally waking up to the fact that there's a population problem in the negative way?
Yeah, it is. You know, and now we need to do IVF. We need more babies instead of stopping abortion. You know, right. we have the babies.
Right.
Why don't we,
and we had
place
them.
These babies
right.
for, you know, adoption but to loving families.
Right, who are desperate for children.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. exactly. They say that abortion is a decision that a woman makes with, quote unquote, her doctor. But most women are not going to their family's physician. So why'd you make that point?
Well, because when a woman is seeking an abortion, she's not usually going to her own doctor. Mm. She's not usually going to her own OB-GYN. She's
right.
going to an abortion facility, and the abortion doctor is, he's a hitman.
Right.
He's there to kill the baby.
Yeah, he has a certain motivation.
Yeah.
You don't go to Planned Parenthood to find out how you can have your baby.
No, because he's being paid to do abortions. And he's not sitting down with her, he's not counseling her, he's not listening to her fears or concerns. He's somebody else is prepping the woman, and he's coming in and doing it.
Right.
Just recently, a woman was that I met was talking about with hers. She said we were lined up like cattle.
Right.
And he comes in, he aborts one, he moves to the next table, aborts that one. Sometimes they're in the same room.
Right.
Sometimes it's adjoining rooms, but they're not. It's not her doctor.
Right.
He doesn't have any concern for her. He's never seen the woman before.
And he hopes to never see her again.
Yeah. Doesn't care about her.
Right.
You know? She's just somebody who's doing abortion. He's going to be paid his $500 or whatever it is. And he's just processing.
He'll probably head out of town.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you talked about, you know, the parental pressure. And you also talk about the pressure that can come from the father, the child. We kind of get that idea, especially in the world today where nobody wants to be responsible for it as well. You also, the pressure to abort can come from a young woman's social group. What would be an example of that?
So sometimes, like in college, mm-hmm. you know, it can be her sorority sisters or her circle of friends, and they're like, oh, no, you're only a freshman or sophomore in college. If you have this baby, this is going to ruin your mm-hmm. career. You will not be able to finish college, you know. So it can be that whole social circle.
You're going to ruin your life.
Yeah, basically. You're going to ruin your life. And sometimes they're saying, you know, well, I had an abortion and it's no big deal. You know,
good
just
point.
Go ahead and do it and you get it over with and then you can move on with your life. And a lot of time those other women, yeah, they had abortions, mm-hmm. but they're in denial mm-hmm. of their own pain and may even be unconsciously spreading that pain to others. You know, the more of us who go through this, it kind of justifies the
right,
fact
of my
decision.
More people who do the bad thing I did, the less guilty I feel about it.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
You say, and this was interesting, and I think we're seeing it in society more and more, so it's a good point. Pressure to have an abortion can come from a woman's employer. Having a baby might force the employer to allow for time away, et cetera, like that. And I also think in a lot of times, this is just my own supposition from having worked in the media, but a lot of these people who've achieved these great goals in the media who are talking about these things, you know, the odds of having had an abortion in their own lives, and especially if anyone who reads about Hollywood in the
right.
old days and the number of abortions that so many of these famous female actresses were forced to have.
Right. Well, and you just saw recently Stevie Nicks coming out with a song justifying the abortion that she had 50 years ago mm-hmm. with Don Henley.
Right.
You know, and you can tell that Stevie Nicks has been in pain for 50 years, but she's still denying the reality of it.
Mm-hmm.
And she's still trying to say that, well, Fleetwood Mac wouldn't exist. We wouldn't have been able to do all the great things if I'd had that baby.
Right.
You know,
and you don't know that to be true.
No, you don't know that to be true at all. And there's other people who are big music stars, and they took time out, had babies,
mm-hmm.
and then the group got back together. And you know, so there's this justification mm-hmm. that people do. You know, they try to say, well, it was no big deal, it was the right decision, but deep down, they're just trying to cover over and deny their pain. Because if they admit what they did and they admit how it hurt them, then they would have to to make changes.
Right.
And they don't want to do that. They're afraid to do that.
Right, that's the big thing. Nobody, if we deny it, then we don't have to change, because if we admit to something, then we're going to have to change, and we may not want to change, or we may not want to look too deeply back into that decision-making process. You also, you talk about forced abortions in the sense of women being and deciding late and then being forced to have it anyway, but you actually connected here too with something which has really become a much bigger issue, which is really trafficking.
Yes. Yeah, and a lot of women who are trafficked, you know, they basically are forced into effectively prostitution, but they are not willing to do partners in this at all, and they get pregnant, and the trafficker just brings them to Planned Parenthood, and they do abortions, and they, you know, so, and the very fact that Planned Parenthood resists reporting on trafficking or reporting on underage abortions and stuff, they're covering over that a lot of these women, they do not want it. They don't want it at all.
And they're also living in situations that are probably illegal.
Oh, yes.
Many cases where they're underage.
Yeah. But even if they were adults, if they're still trafficking victims, they actually don't have any say over it at all. And so you can imagine the additional trauma that they have, because they're basically slaves.
Right.
And they're being forced into doing
it. It's like a concept we just can't wrap our minds around anymore, the idea that these people are being moved around the country and are, you know, being locked up basically and officially, you know, and being used in that way.
Right. And I wonder how many, I keep hearing about things in the border and how many of the women coming across the border are raped by the cartels, you know, and how many of those women are end up being forced into abortions.
Sure.
You know, so the whole thing that people keep saying, oh, it's a woman's choice, a woman and her doctor, a lot of time, maybe the majority of the time, possibly well over the majority of the time, it's not a woman's free choice. A woman is being pressured or coerced in some way.
If all things were equal,
many of them would not have abortions.
Right, exactly. You also talk about the fact that studies have shown that previous sexual abuse is very high in women who end up having abortions.
Right. Yes, yeah, so because these women have already been traumatized through sexual abuse or molestation. And so they don't have a very high self-esteem, self-respect because of what they've suffered. And it makes them more vulnerable to bad partnerships, hooking up with the wrong kind of guy, because they're extremely wounded. Mm-hmm. And then those are not the kind of guys that are gonna step up and say, yeah, I'm gonna help you to have this baby. I'm gonna to be there for you. You know, so you kind of have one, you have the fact that they were molested or abused, and then the bad situation that leads to the pregnancy, that leads to the abortion, and then oftentimes a cycle of this.
Right, where there's an unworthiness, and I'm not, you know, this is how I should be treated because I was treated this way when I was younger or something. And also the fact that, and you quote our friend Dr. Teresa Burke from years ago from Guttmacher about the fact that so many abortions, when people talk about it, you shouldn't add those onto each additional woman, because the women who have it, if you have one, there's a high likelihood you'll have more than one, right?
Yeah, it's a very high percentage, nearly 50% of women who have abortions actually end up having multiple abortions.
Right.
And it's a cycle called traumatic reenactment. So a lot of time the woman is trying to gain control over what had spun out of control, and it leads her to repeating the cycle, and it just further deepens the wound.
Well, it's interesting, you talk about the traumatic grief, and you talk about the way that post-traumatic stress disorder, at least we would see it you know, that way, but the American Psychological Association kind of pushes back against that kind of approach and saying there's really anything going on negatively. Why do they do that?
Well, I think largely they do it because they are pro-abortion, and they don't want to admit that abortion has negative consequences. But if we look at it objectively, all the different symptoms of PTSD, you can see those same symptoms in women who've had abortions.
Right. Now, in the section part two, healing the spiritual wounds of abortion, how does one go about healing the spiritual wound of an abortion? And what is a spiritual wound? You say it's restoring our relationship with God.
Right. So when a person has an abortion or is involved in abortion, so the mother or father who forced their daughter or pressured their daughter to have an abortion, or the father of the baby who was involved in the decision also have these wounds.
Right.
It's a spiritual turning away from God. Even the person, if a woman was coerced into having it, she often feels that at that point she's some way turned away from God because she could have stopped it, or maybe she right. should. Even if she actually couldn't, she thinks she could have. And so because they've
taken
this...
God is holding that against her.
Right. And
could
so
never forgive her.
They feel like, yeah, they've, right. they've committed the unforgivable sin, which it's not mm-hmm. the unforgivable by any means, mm-hmm. but they're like, how could God forgive this? Mm-hmm. And so that relationship with God has to be healed.
Right.
And that course starts with coming to God, approaching God in prayer. You can coming to our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament to pray for grace,
right.
But also coming to confession.
Right.
And so approaching a priest.
I was going to say you know, say confession quite a bit in the book and even in the already in our discussion.
Right. Well, the sacrament of confession right. is the place of. Healing. It's where
okay.
we meet Jesus as the divine physician, as the healer, and you know where our Lord. It's the parable of the prodigal son brought into our lives. You know, it's where we meet Jesus, where He embraces us in His merciful love,
mm-hmm.
and welcomes us back. No matter how far we've been, no matter what we've done, He's right. there to welcome us back.
I think this is a good point you make here. For me, God has created us as creatures who are both. Body and soul. Both our bodies and our souls are involved in our choices to do good or to do evil.
Right. Yeah, and it's not just a spiritual decision, it's not just a bodily decision. And so both body and soul have to be engaged in coming back to God. And that's part of why God designed it in the sacraments, that the sacraments have physical reality elements to them. You know, we go to confession, you know, we go in, we say what we've done, we may express out loud an act of contrition, we accept a penance, you know, we hear the advice from the priest, we hear the words of absolution. So just as our body was involved in the decision of our sin, so our body is involved in that reconciliation with God.
Right, you talk about the idea of how you have to counsel people in a chapter here, also the idea, which I didn't realize, that some of the penitents come in and wonder whether, in fact, they've been excommunicated
right,
because of
right.
the act.
Yeah, it's interesting because there is an excommunication attached to abortion, mm-hmm. But it's only when people knew there was an excommunication. Mm-hmm. So church law works the opposite of American law. American law, there's like 300,000 different things that you can go wrong, and even if you didn't know that you were committing violating the law, you can still be sent to prison for it.
Right.
In church law, if you don't know something is contrary to the law, you're not guilty,
right.
and you can't be held accountable for it. And so a lot of people, they hear after the fact, oh, there was an excommunication. Oh, somebody will say, you were excommunicated.
Right.
And then they think, oh, that means I can't come back to God.
Right.
And it's the opposite.
Right.
You know.
And if they were forced, then it wasn't their free will.
Exactly.
So,
and most didn't know there was an excommunication.
Right.
And if there was coercion, then they weren't excommunicated.
Mm-hmm.
But even if somebody was, even if they fully knew and were excommunicated, excommunication is simply, it's a medicine. It's
right.
helping a person realize, I need to get back to God.
Right.
And that very fact that they come back, they've already made the big step.
Mm-hmm.
And the priest takes care of it.
Do you like to peel onions, or are you just good at it?
I don't know if I like to peel to peel the onions that make my eyes water.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, we have that peeling the onion as far as the priest working with the person who is... sometimes people, they've gone to confession, they've made a good confession, and then later on something comes up and they remember more. It's stages. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
God only allows people to remember so much of their past at a time, because if they remembered everything at once, it'd be too painful.
Yeah, it'd be overwhelming.
Yeah, and so the Lord, in His mercy, allows them to see some of it, to confess it, and then later on allows them to see more. And then they confess it, and the Lord just keeps working until He gets them through everything.
Well, what would be an example of a post-abortion Bible study?
So there's several. One is called, probably the most common one in America, is called Forgiven and Set Free.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of pregnancy resources have it. And so it's usually like a 12 or 14-week program where women would come together at a place, and they would work through this Bible study that would help them going through the scriptures, to believe more that Jesus is capable of forgiving and of healing the wound. So there's several of those, and I have a chapter talking about the Bible studies.
At least three listed here that I have. Surrendering the Secret, and another one called
Save One.
Save One is another one. You mentioned earlier, and it's a wonderful, Rachel Vineyards and the retreats, et cetera. You talk about that. You also talked about something called Entering Canaan Retreat Ministry. What's that?
So a lady named Teresa Bonaparte started Entering Canaan in New York some years ago, and she does it, and also the Sisters of Life do it. They kind of both operate the same program. It's a very, it's a retreat, very sacramental focused. Priests giving talks, and then confession, adoration, mass. And they'll often have several times they'll meet in preparation for that retreat, and then they'll have follow-up times after the retreat. It's a very good retreat ministry for healing after abortion. Unfortunately, it's only in a few places in the United States, and so people have to live in those metropolitan areas where it's offered. But for those who do, it would be a good alternative. Whereas Rachel's Vineyard is more widespread.
Right.
And that's the one that I do. We have about 400 teams in 80 countries putting on Rachel's Vineyard retreats, and I think 35 languages. So ours is a little bit more accessible.
I don't know if that's good or bad, the fact that we have to have so many.
It means that we're reaching into more places.
Right, absolutely.
Abortion is spread all over the world, and so bringing it as local to people as possible to get healing.
Absolutely. How long did it take you to write this book?
Believe it or not, I wrote the draft in a week, and then I revised it in a week.
Okay. Well, it's very deep, even though it's short, so easy for people to get through, get a lot out of it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me
on. That's okay. Father Ben J. Cameron, CPM, Healing the Deepest Wounds, a pastoral guide to abortion, trauma, and grief, modern media, naturally available through the EWTN Religious Catalog. Mother would love this book. Check it out. Get it through our catalog. And, of course, look for another episode of EWTN's Bookmark coming soon right here on EWTN. We'll catch you next time.